You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Pete Hamill was a brilliant journalist and novelist and lifelong New Yorker. He died on August 5th, 2020, at the age of 85. I was lucky enough to have had Pete Hamill as a guest on this show in 2014, and I want to share that interview with you tonight. The occasion of our interview was the publication of a book of short stories called The Christmas Kid. We began our conversation talking about how technology has changed the way people read.
But in a way, I think the technology can help the various mediums, including fiction. You know, if you think that of all the great writers, far greater than I am, who wrote for newspapers, Dickens, Hemingway, Damon Runyon, all kinds of people did that in other countries, Alberto Moravia, and in Italy, and Kafu Nagai in Japan, and you know, there was a tradition of writing short fiction for newspapers, and we've lost it somewhere. You know, we think somehow that's not part of the deal, when particularly in the popular papers where all the space is taken up by bikini babes in January, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Freezing half the female audience out of the room. What I would hope would be that particularly for short stories, since there's so few outlets that carry short stories anymore, which is one of the great, great media in fiction. The only place you can get published, basically, is in academic small literary magazines, yeah, or The New Yorker.
Yeah.
There's nowhere else, and there's no reason why the Internet might provide a home for more of those kind of stories and allow people to get an audience.
Do you ever personally read things on the Internet?
I mean, I do. I look at certain papers all the time.
And yeah.
I look at the Irish Times and the Wall Street Journal. And, mainly because I can't get those papers easily where I live.
Yeah. Well, you live in New York, don't you?
Yeah, I live in Tribeca.
Can't you get anything in New York for, you know?
Well, you know, a good example is right around the corner there's a newsstand that sells cigarettes and, you know, the usual stuff, potato chips. but it does not have newspapers on Saturday and Sunday. You can't get Sunday Daily News. You can't get a Sunday Times. We get the Times delivered, but... do I prefer paper? Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Am I used to the other, particularly when I'm traveling? Yes.
Yeah.
Earlier this year, I spent 7 weeks in Sicily researching a new novel and writing it. And it was almost impossible to find a newspaper there for whatever reason. In 2 years... the newspapers that I used to get there, the local papers where I could sort of figure out from the noun and the verb what the story's about, gone. You know, I don't know if they're out of business or the stands don't carry them anymore. I just don't know, but I couldn't find them. So I go online and take a look.
If you're
looking for something like basketball coverage or something, you definitely have to do it when you're traveling.
Well, you know, if you live in New York, then that spoils you for a lot of stuff. I mean, for instance, you can't get anything to eat. You can't get anything. You know, only in New York, and if it's 11 o'clock at night, you want to go get eggs or a pizza. So,
<That's true.
laughs> you know, I grew up and spent most of my life in California, but like the song says, I happen to like New York. And you've lived in so many of the great cities of the world, but New York is your thing. What is it about New York for you?
I think it's both a combination of the familiar and the surprising. That I know where everything is. The Bronx is up and the Battery's down, you know?
Yeah.
I know the grid. I know where I am when I'm here. But on the other hand, I know that the rapidity of change in a city like New York, since it's still a dynamic city, it's not a museum, is what holds the surprises for you. When I was 30 years ago, there were not that many good Japanese restaurants. Now there's many of them. 30 years ago, you could buy a typewriter ribbon anywhere. Now it's
so you could get your
like
film
a
developed.
Treasured thing for anybody that still has. I
still do you still use it? You still use your typewriter?
I don't know. No. I have one in case it's the immense power failure of all time. I still have one with a reasonably fresh ribbon, but I don't know if I had a right. More than 40 pages, what the hell they would look like. Might be dried out into cinder blocks or something. But also because it's an immigrant town, there's a, and because of the rapidity of change, nostalgia is one of the most powerful emotions in a city like New York. People think of it as a heartless, big, faceless kind of city, and it's not. The immigrants who came from other places to settle in New York are still carrying around the places, the fields where they ran barefoot in the summertime, and they'll carry those to their grave, whether they were in Sicily or in China or wherever the hell they are. The constant shifting. You go away for the summer. When you come back, your favorite coffee shop is gone, and Donald Trump is still shoving something in the ground there where it used to be, you know?
Yeah.
Or in the monster examples, we lose two baseball teams and two football teams. We don't even have an NFL team in football.
Penn Station is gone. Did you hear about that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nostalgia isn't what it used to be, I hear.
Yeah. That's who wrote that? Simone Signore?
I think so. That was the title of her book.
Yeah. But that understanding that, you can decode some of the things that are going on around you. There's certain Chinese musicians that show up at Canal Street and Subway Station, and they play music that has an ache in it. And you know what the ache is for? It's for the place left behind. It's just like the Irish 100 years ago singing about emigration from Ireland and knowing they would never go back. So seeing that, there's a kind of commonality to a lot of the people that live here. That's what I find rich and endlessly fascinating.
I guess that's why Jolson was a success in New York, because the songs he sang, even though they weren't his personal nostalgia, were someone's nostalgia for Mammy and back home.
Oh, yeah. Well, the one I liked by him was The Spaniard That Blighted My Life. all about how he went out for some nuts in a program at a bullfight, and the bullfighter stole his girlfriend away, you know. One of the lines is, I'll raise a bunion on his Spanish onion, the Spaniard that blighted my life. But a lot of these guys, although they had the achy kind of sentimental songs, they also had comedy.
Yep.
They knew that the best way to handle adversity in a place like New York was to laugh at it. And the unforgivable sin was self-pity. You don't ever feel sorry for yourself. And that's true with today's immigrants the way it was true 100 years ago with the Italians, the Irish, and the Jews. And I hope that's the way it'll go. We'll have some people from Mars here yet.
They're probably already there.
Yeah, as long as they don't go to the Bronx, they're okay.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're listening back to my 2014 interview with the brilliant journalist and novelist, New Yorker Pete Hamill. He died on August 5th at the age of 85.
One of my favorite books of yours is a slim little volume called Why Sinatra Matters.
Right.
You not only have an appreciation for Sinatra, but you actually knew the guy.
I did know him, yeah.
What kind of a person was he?
First of all, you know, in spite of the Rat Pack image and all that stuff, he was very smart, and he was a reader. Just one example. He was an insomniac. He couldn't sleep at night very easily. The habits of a lifetime, you know, working in saloons at 2 o'clock in the morning instead
of... Yeah.
And so he would read. He was the guy that came up with the idea of taking Nelson Algren's Man with the Golden Arm and making a movie out of it. It wasn't a movie producer. It was Frank. And he was able to get enough people interested that they made a terrific movie out of it. So he would call. He knew that I would work nights a lot. And his other great friend here was Jimmy Cannon, the sports writer, who also was an insomniac. So it was like a network where if he was in town, if he, being Sinatra, was in town, don't be surprised if you get a call at 11:30 at night saying, "What are you doing?" You know, and off we go to P.J. Clark's or Patsy's or one of the places. But he was very smart about things. I mean, and particularly obviously about his music. He had listened carefully to different people. He listened to Tommy Dorsey and other, who was a beautiful melodic liquid trombone player and band leader. And he listened to the way he phrased music, when to sustain a note, etc. He listened to Billie Holiday and noted he didn't try to sing like her. He did try to do what she did, which was to take music written by other people and turn it into autobiography. And by doing that, Sinatra, along with Joe DiMaggio and Fiorella LaGuardia, drove the stereotype of the Italian immigrant with the monkey and the organ grinder, drove it right off the stage, never to return. Suddenly, the Italians were urban. The Italians were not peasants from the back of Sicily or Calabria, wherever. They were urban. And Sinatra was instrumental in that. And years later, I began to run into people, Puerto Ricans, for example, some of my friends who are Puerto Rican, who learned how to speak carefully in English by listening to Sinatra, because the phrasing in the songs was so clear, was so exact. And they listened to that and repeated the words to get it right. So he had an effect on people other than the Italians, the Irish, and the Jews, but all the new arrivals who were coming into the city. Indirectly had an influence just by the way he did things. So That's why I called it Why Sinatra Matters. It was not the Gone with the Wind of Sinatra's love life or something. You know, it was about why the music mattered, why it was different. He came along and American popular music turned urban because Crosby, as good as he was from area code 800. You know, we don't know where he's from. From Walla Walla, Washington or wherever.
Yeah.
And he was very good, but that's why he and Sinatra together were very good.
What a swelligant, elegant party this is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I learned some stuff in school when I was young, but I also learned a lot of important things from reading the back of album jackets. And I read and reread the back of Dylan's Blood on the Tracks LP many, many times. And on that album in 1974... you wrote about us surviving the plague, and
yeah.
and you were on the front lines of that plague, weren't you?
Yeah, I was there. Yeah, you know, I didn't quite think of it that way in the present tense of the thing, but when I would step back and mull it for a while, I said, "Holy cry, I'm lucky I'm alive." It was quite an amazing period, wonderful time. I give you a good example of the kind of things that you learned. I was in London doing some work on something, some piece that I was doing. And I had cousins there from Ireland who lived in London. And they started raving about this group called the Beatles. So I sent a cable to, no internet in those days, I sent a cable to my editor at the Saturday Evening Post. I said, there's this British rock and roll group called the Beatles everybody's talking about. Maybe I should do a piece. Back came a cable to me the next day. Beatles Schmeedles. Who cares about a British rock and roll band? And I kept it for years because... I would run into him every once in a while. Hey, I got a cover. Hey, Bill, look at this. So since the music was, you know, I offer that only as an example of the kind of thing that was going on.
Yeah.
To have a ringside seat for a lot of it, which is what I had as a reporter, it was a huge privilege, although I didn't think of it that way. It seemed like that's the way the world was, and the world was going to be that way for a long time. And it wasn't, but it was a great, exhilarating time, as you can see a whole consciousness forming out of the wreckage of different things, out of Vietnam, out of the new generation, the children of the GI Bill, who made up the new middle class, etc. It was a great historical time.
We're talking with Pete Hamill. When did Robert Kennedy decide to run for president? Were you there when he was making those decisions?
No, I wasn't. I was in Ireland, but I had sent him a letter making all the arguments for it. I knew him a little from covering politics. And I don't have a copy of it. Richard Reeves had a copy of that letter.
Hmm.
And I made the argument that you can't wait. You know, this is crucial to the country. Somebody's got to change this thing and do something about it, because by then I had gone to Vietnam. My brother John was in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive as a soldier. I had friends who went there and had their brains scrambled by the place. And that was 68. And 67, 68, and I was making the argument that you can't wait, and which help persuade him. He knew that after his brother, after John Kennedy was killed. Bobby learned from that that you can't wait. You couldn't. Jack Kennedy talked about pulling out and getting out of Laos and getting out of Vietnam, where there were advisors posing as champions of democracy and stuff. So you had to do it when the opportunity was there. You couldn't wait till the next election. You couldn't wait 4 more years. You had to do it. Because who knows who's standing in the shadows with a rifle ready to kill you. So I think it gave him an urgency, him being Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah.
An urgency that Jack didn't have, even though Jack had been in the war and survived the war. But he thought he had 8 years coming, and he didn't. So that sense of the clock ticking, of the urgency of being an American, is still something I feel when I drift back into that period for whatever reason, either suggested by music or seeing some anniversary on television or whatever. Unfortunately, we didn't learn anything from it.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you, in 1975, 74, when Blood on the Tracks came out, and we thought about, oh, well, the plague is over, Nixon's gone, the war is over, but, you know, it seemed like another plague, you know, a worse plague.
Yeah.
And which is still maybe going on.
Yeah. And one reason, of course, was that after the war ended badly and we had lost the war, there were no major hearings in Washington where you try to sort it out and figure out what happened. What should we learn from this? Etc. One reason being the Watergate came along and crowded it right out of the front pages of the papers and off television. And because Watergate and the hearings involving Watergate came and dominated, we never had the discussion about Vietnam. Now, obviously, we had many books on Vietnam. I was with, the other night, I was with Peter Arnett, who saw more combat than all the generals put together in Vietnam. He was 13 years in Vietnam. And he said that there's roughly 30,000 books about the Vietnam War, and nobody reads any of them, you know?
But there was never, like, a Warren Commission or whatever to...
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, exactly. And after World War II, we had hearings, too, about were we forewarned about the Japanese impending, planning an attack, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they had some impact on the way the history was written. But Vietnam... No lessons, and one of the lessons should have been that nationalism is a much more strong, a more powerful force than any economic theory. They were not sitting in those spider holes in Vietnam, the Viet Cong, discussing Marx's theory of surplus value. They were talking about how do we get the foreigners the hell out of our country. And we didn't learn that, and off we go to Afghanistan a generation later, and like we're going to turn it into Minnesota, and we see the consequences there after a decade.
Yeah, that is, you know, you go to a place where you don't understand the culture.
Yeah.
And that we do it exactly the same thing every time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And now with Chapo under arrest, that makes Karzai the leading drug dealer in the in the world now, or his family. The poppies are blooming. I hate to sound cynical about it, but I just wish a little sustained skepticism was in part of our foreign policy. I really do.
That was Pete Hamill, the brilliant journalist and novelist and lifelong New Yorker, who died on August 5th, 2020. I recorded that interview in 2014. Stick around, though, because after the break, I'll be talking with novelist Andrea Bartz about her new book, The Herd. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Welcome back to From the Bookshelf here on KSCO.
Andrea Bartz returns to the show this week. Last year, she published her debut novel, The Lost Night. It was a great success, and late last year, Newsweek named Andrea Bartz's new novel, The Herd, as one of the most anticipated novels of 2020. Well, the anticipation is over because The Herd has arrived, and Andrea Bartz, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much for having me.
So right before the book was going to come out, there was all this excitement and anticipation, and I'm sure you were thinking, I'm going to tour the world and meet all these people, and then this crazy thing happened. I know for me that there was just like this gradual dawning over the course of that second weekend in March when one by one, all the things that I wanted to do disappeared in front of me.
Right.
What was that like for you?
Yeah, we watched all of our plans just sort of evaporate over the course of a couple of days. It was rough. My book came out March 26th. So it was 2 days after all the bookstores in at least New York City and a lot of places closed down. A lot of people who'd pre-ordered just got notifications that their order had been canceled and refunded. It's not a great time to have a book come out. And it was a huge bummer in terms of my plans for promoting the book. As you said, there was a lot of early buzz and excitement, and it really felt like this book maybe was going to have some traction. And that same period in sort of early March, just watching bookstores pull out of the tour that I'd spent months planning and realizing that none of that was going to happen was pretty tough. So, you know, someday I'll have a story about that time my book came out in the thick of an epidemic.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're one of the people I immediately thought of when I thought of, oh, all my friends have books coming out, and what a bummer. I mean, there's so many. I mean, we're alive, and that's wonderful, and you know, there's a lot of worse things that have happened as a result, but there are things that are happening, even though they may not be the worst possible things that could ever happen, that are still a bummer.
Yeah, bummer is definitely the right word, and I'm totally aware that I'm fortunate to have to still be able to work and to have my apartment and food and my health and all those things. But man, did it suck to have a book come out and not be able to celebrate and to watch, you know, retail sales of everything, including books, plunge. It's just a bummer.
It does seem like it's a good time to do some reading. So maybe that will be helpful to The Herd.
Yeah, people hope for that. It's a pretty good escapist read, I think.
No, I think so too. I love it. I think it's a great book and I want to talk about it. But I saw, I think it was a Twitter from you or something that said, my book tour has been canceled, not postponed. And it just seemed like a horrible moment.
Well, because so many people kept saying, I can't wait to see you when it's rescheduled. And I was kind of like, don't wait for that because it's not happening. Just go order the book, you know? Stop waiting. It's not it doesn't work like that. The bookstores aren't just holding a place for me down the line. So.
Well, maybe that'll happen. Who knows? Maybe next year when the book comes out in paperback, you can do a tour or something like that.
Here's hoping the world looks a little better by then.
But I know a lot of people are, you know, I mean, everyone is sheltering in place, and that's a nice time to do some reading. I've been doing lots of reading, and among the reading I've been doing is I read this new novel by Andrea Bartz called The Herd, and I love it. It's a great book. And it's a thriller, so I don't want to tell it. I don't want to say anything about it. So you tell us, what should we know about The Herd?
Sure. So The Herd is a thriller that is set in an exclusive elite all-female co-working space in New York City that's called The Herd, emphasis on the H-E-R, because it's all about her. And the CEO and founder of The Herd is this sort of glamorous, ambitious, successful young woman named Eleanor, and she vanishes the night of an important company announcement. She doesn't show up at this glitzy news conference. And so it's up to her closest friends, who are also sort of her co-founders, they were there since day one, to try to figure out what happened to her and if she left voluntarily or if foul play was involved. The Herd had some enemies by sort of virtue of being a, you know, feminist, women-focused space. And so, you know, it's told from the perspective of two of her close friends who are sisters, who have very different sort of worldviews and approaches to digging and to being amateur detectives. And it really goes deep on themes of consumerist feminism and complex female friendships and really the sky-high expectations that we have for high-achieving, ambitious, successful women in the world. But above all that, it's just supposed to be juicy and fun and twisty and fast and an escapist read, and especially great for anyone who misses their coworkers right now, because it's all about that, you know, professional co-working, juicy, gossipy life.
In fact, your story kind of ends in March of 2020, doesn't it?
It ends on New Year's Day 2020.
Yeah.
So these characters, it's like they have no idea what's coming for them.
Well, you know, you said that above it all is the thriller, but I was wondering if that's exactly true. Like when I read The Lost Night, which I also really loved, I felt like, and I loved the thriller aspect of it, but it was really about these friends and looking back on this time that they had a year before or 10 years before in New York. And it seemed like you want to talk about that part of it as much as the thriller part. So I'm wondering if that's true here. Do you start as thinking about a thriller, or do you start with these characters and their situation and then, oh, here's how I could make a thriller out of it. Which is it?
That's a great question. So what I really love doing is setting a mystery within, it's kind of both, because I love setting a mystery within this interesting sort of close-knit, closed-door world where there's interesting characters that have complex friendships and relationships and, you know, juicy dynamics between them. And within that social milieu, I like to throw, you know, a dead body or throw a mystery of some kind. So, you know, for The Lost Night, that setting was this sort of where the warehouse parties of hipster Brooklyn in 2009. And that was sort of its own little bubble of the recession. And for this book, I started with the idea of this beautiful, exclusive, you know, progressive feminist utopia, this co-working space. And let's cross that with a thriller element. So I really start with the setting more so than the character or the mystery. And then from the setting, characters start to emerge. And then the questions of what will make this a mystery or thriller and not just a, you know, coming of age or interesting social literary fiction begin to emerge.
The Herd itself, is that, what is that based on? Is there anything like The Herd?
Probably the closest, and I'm not the first to say this, there is a very beautiful all-female co-working space called The Wing that started in New York and now has locations all over the world. In fact, it's in Europe and across America. And it similarly, you know, kind of became a flashpoint for these cultural discussions about consumerist feminism, but it also, you know, was set up to be this beautiful, airy, female-focused space that's inclusive and mentorship, you know, all about mentorship and empowerment. But the Wing is one of many. It's really a trend where there's also the Riveter and the Luminary and the Coven and the Assembly. There's actually a lot of all-female co-working spaces right now. So when people say like, oh, this is about the Wing, I do correct them. It's really, I was inspired by sort of that whole trend of co-working spaces that are aimed specifically at non-men.
Non-men. Oh, that's a good.
Well, women and I think in the book they say women and marginalized genders, because it's not just, some people don't identify as women and they're still welcome.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Just as long as they're not men.
Pretty much, as long as they don't identify as men.
Okay. And when you create your female characters, or your male characters for that matter, any of your characters, they're very, you know, they feel like really real people. And I wonder, do you do a whole lot of, you know, like a method actor would come up with a backstory that's off stage or off screen for their character, but they know it and it's in their head. Do you have like little biographies of all of your characters?
I think a lot of writers do that. They have sort of, you know, backstories and they do character sketches and character studies. I don't myself. I write the first draft in a complete sort of feral mess of several months of not knowing what's going on and who these characters are and what they're doing. And so they're all kind of paper dolls to begin with, and then they gain personalities as things go on based on sort of the decisions they make and how the plot emerges and the sort of, you know, roles that they can play within within the story and the narrative. And then once I have a complete draft that's a mess, then I kind of, by the end, I know who these people are, and that's when I go back and try to sort of strengthen the character development throughout. But in this case, and in every case, I try to think about the main characters as sort of representing different approaches to the central theme or the central question. And hopefully it's subtle enough that as a reader you wouldn't notice, but you know, it helps me sort of distinguish their personalities and characters. And in this book, it's really going deep on the roles that women, successful women, are allowed to play in society, right? Like what are sort of the approaches that women can take to be successful and still be liked and loved and accepted and you know, validated and listened to. And so, you know, the main characters within this book all kind of take different approaches. And probably the easiest example to see that is these two narrators, Hannah and Katie. And Hannah is very much that, she's the PR director for the Herd, and she's totally on top of everything. She is the person you go to in a crisis. She takes care of things. She takes care of everyone's needs before they even, you know, realize they have them. And people, you know, love and appreciate her for that. And then her little sister, Katie, a journalist, is that sort of brash, funny, she's a guy's kind of girl, people love her, she gets them laughing as soon as they meet her, she speaks without thinking, and so that's kind of, she's learned that is an acceptable route for her to endear people to her. Again, not in a malicious way, but like I think especially women from the time we're born start to learn, like there are limited roles to play, and you got to pick your, you know, pick your armor or pick your mask and move forward and sort of watch for that feedback to figure out what works for you. And it was fun to play with dual narrators because I think humans in general can sort of fall into the trap of feeling like I don't know what I'm doing or I'm being fake or I'm being an imposter, but everyone else knows exactly what they're doing and is being very authentic. And with these two sisters, you know, Hannah looks at her little sister and she thinks, God, I wish I could be just funny and charming and effortlessly magnetic like her and just, you know, let myself be imperfect. And she's just so loved for it. And then Katie looks at her older sister and thinks, man, I'm such a hot mess in comparison to Hannah. I wish that I could be on top of things. I wish I could be as together as her. She makes it look so easy. And so it's sort of, you know, a way for me to distinguish characters and also to sort of get at that theme of what happens when women, when their perfect veneers begin to crack in this sort of crucible of a tough situation.
That thing you were talking about imposters, you know, that people feel like that everybody feels this way. And you have sort of at some point in your book, you quote somebody and, I can't remember it exactly, but I'm sure you do. So I want to know if that's that research, is that real or made up?
Yes. So the answer is yes. The research is absolutely real. So the context is that there's three interstitials throughout the book, breaking up the sort of parts, the acts, and they're all entries from sort of the lifestyle blog that Eleanor, the Herd CEO, runs. And one of them is all about imposter syndrome and how it's not a real thing. It sort of like took off in our, you know, cultural lexicon, but the research that established it has actually been disproven and revoked. And the truth is, imposter syndrome was presented as sort of a something that's wrong with you, as sort of, you know, a pathology. And in reality, it's nobody could replicate the studies of these women who presented it as something that sort of singularly afflicts young professional women. Because it turns out everyone feels this. It's just a completely normal part of the human experience. And so there's in a quote unquote blog post about that, but it uses very real research demonstrating that this thing that we think of as an affliction to be fixed is actually just a completely normal thing that absolutely everyone experiences, which is sometimes feeling like you're faking it.
Yes, I'm familiar with this.
Nobody knows what they're doing. We should be worried about the weirdos who don't have that feeling sometimes.
I think it's hard enough to come up with a good plot for a novel, but then to also have a murder mystery where you have a lot of, you know, you don't want to do the thing where you suddenly come up with the guilty party being somebody that the reader couldn't possibly have guessed because they didn't ever see them before, somebody that comes out of the woodwork. It's got to be somebody built into your story. And how do you, I don't know, how do you come up with all that?
It's so hard. It's so hard because, as you're saying, you have to, it has to be surprising, but also inevitable, which means like that's an impossible tightrope to walk. It needs to be seated properly so that it feels satisfying. But that means that a minority of people are going to guess it. And then those people think it was too obvious because to them, they guessed it earlier. So it's really frustrating. The way that I approach it is I write the entire thing without knowing how it ends and without knowing whodunit, which is a horrible way to write a thriller, and I don't recommend it. But it's
so you don't even know who did it, you're saying?
I don't know. Yeah, I have guesses throughout, and it changes. And sort of my approach is that for the first half of the manuscript or so, I'm just pulling pins out of grenades and like strewing about mouse traps that I've loaded and spring traps and sort of leaving all of these way too many sort of little details or things that I figure I might return to and pick up later and might become relevant. And that part's really fun. And then I get to about the midpoint and I realize I have to start landing all these planes and I'm like, oh my God, like what have I done? Because at this point I've usually introduced so many different mini mysteries and I have no idea what the answer is to any of them. I mean, to give one of a million examples, in the very first chapter, in the very first scene, there's some explicit graffiti that's been written on the wall in the herd. And I wrote that and I had no idea who had done it until while I was writing the entire book. And at one point I thought maybe this person, at one point I thought maybe this party, whatever. I had no idea how it tied in. So I write the whole thing being surprised by every twist and every turn, which hopefully helps with making it surprising for the reader as well. And then when I get to the end, I somehow miraculously, knock wood, so far things fall into place and I have an idea that kind of ties it together.
Well, I'm glad for all of us that it worked out. And what about your next book?
I'm excited about it. It's my first thriller that is not in any way a whodunit. It's not a mystery. It's about two sort of globe-trotting female best friends who kill a backpacker in self-defense during their travels in South America. And that sort of kicks off the story. That's at the beginning. So there's no question of who did what, but there is sort of the thriller element of them trying to get away with it and the event sort of testing their friendship to the limits, stretching it to the limits as the walls close in on them. So it was a lot of fun to write. And I think it'll appeal to a lot of the same readers because it's still very character-based and very much about sort of their complex friendship, but very, very different from the first two.
So let's remind everybody that the new book is called The Herd. And the author is my guest, Andrea Bartz, also the author of The Lost Night, two great thrillers for you to read this weekend. Andrea Bartz, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.